This presentation is brought to you by Submedia. You can check us out online at submedia.tv.
I'm just gonna get things kind of warmed up, and I made a statement earlier about the 350 Day of Action and how much it reminded me of the global protests that happened on the run up to the war in Iraq. And how it essentially, you know, it didn't stop the war. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was sharing a panel with Vandana Shiva and Kathy Pedler and a nun whose name I never can remember. Can you hear me okay? Okay, anyway, I was sharing a panel maybe a year and a half ago with those three. And all of us on the panel understood that we don't live in a democracy. And, you know, I ask people all over the country, do you believe we live in a democracy? Nobody ever says yes. You know, if you ask, does the U.S. or Canadian government, doesn't matter which, take better care of corporations or human beings, you know, we all know the answer to that. And does it, a government of occupation, what it does, the way you can really define it is that what it does is it moves in, it facilitates resource extraction and maximizes production. That's what it does. It doesn't take care of communities. And, you know, we are under a government of occupation. And of course, my American Indian friends say, so what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? Anyway, so we're sitting there on this panel talking, and we all accept that we don't live in a democracy. And everybody in the audience accepts that we don't live in a democracy. And then at one point during our panel, I turned to the nun who does this great anti-war work. She's a wonderful anti-war activist. I turned to her and I said, so how would your activism be different? And how would you act to stop the war differently if you fully internalize the understanding that we don't live in a democracy? And she turned to me and she said, I have no idea. And so that's one of the lessons we get from this today is, I'm not saying that we shouldn't mobilize and we shouldn't organize. Of course, we need to mobilize. We need to organize. But we should never forget that the function of the government, any government really, is to serve those in power. And we should also never forget that those in power are quite often psychopaths. And about a week ago tomorrow, I was interviewed by Chris Hedges for an article that came out last Monday on Truthdig, and it's gotten a lot of play. And during the interview, one of the things that didn't make it to the final draft was, you know, he said, you talk about, you know, the need to bring down civilization and the need to, you know, act decisively to defend the planet. And so does that mean that does that mean that you sort of don't really like people like Bill McKibben? And I said, no, that's not it at all, for a couple reasons. One is that I think that I'm not one of those people who believes in the reform versus revolution dichotomy, that I think if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left. And if at the same time, all we do is reform work and all we do is beg, then this culture is going to continue to grind away. I think we need it all. And so if this is seen as one part of a broader culture of resistance, then I think that's really great and really important. If somehow people believe that all we need to do is to petition the government, then that's not very helpful, because it's still begging, because asking without the power to back it up, to say or else, is merely begging. And begging isn't sufficient. And there have to be consequences. I mean, before we got on the Skype here, or before I went public here, when Frank was talking to me privately, he asked if I had watched the film that he sent me today that he showed you. And I said no, because I got burgled again. And I've been burgled like 8 times in the last year and a half, and it's getting really old. And for a while, it's like, well, maybe they will just quit on their own. And then after that, it was like, well, I need to take care of myself. And so one of the things I've done, I have a gun for one thing, but that's not really the point. The point right now is that I got video cameras, and I've got their pictures. I now have their names because it's a small community, and I showed the videotapes to. It's very nice. I mean, just they're so stupid. They wore bandanas coming into the house, and once they got in the house, they took the bandanas off. And you know, it's just a smile for the cameras, motherfucker. And it's a small town, so I've got their names. And last week, I went to a private investigator because I still didn't really want to go to the cops. I went to a private investigator, and he was going to go scare them by saying, look, you know, you're either going to go to prison or you're going to stop. But they came again today, so fuck it. I'm going to the cops. And the point is that when I was going to, before today, what I was going to do is I was going to send the private investigator to talk to them and to ask them to stop. But he wasn't going to simply ask them to stop. He was going to say, either you stop or you go to prison. Because in California, burglary of a residence is a mandatory prison sentence and a mandatory felony. You can't plead it down. So he was going to ask them nicely. It's like the old Al Capone line. You get a lot more respect when you ask. Let's see, how's it go? You get more respect when you use a nice word and a gun than you do when you use just a nice word. And the point is that if 350, if all it is just begging, then we're even more fucked than we think we are. But if it's part of organizing a larger culture of resistance, that's great. I want to say one more thing, which is that only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. 98% of the people did support work. You know, before you had the IRA, you had 800 years or 900 years of British occupation, but you also had like the Gaelic language revival and the literature revival. And those are important parts of any culture of resistance. You know, I love to make fun of pacifists, but the truth is you couldn't have had Underground Railroads without the Quakers. And so we need the 350 movement as an above ground arm of a movement to stop this. But you know, I got to say one more thing. I don't like 350. I think it should be called the 250 movement, because giving 350, that's really fucked up, because what carbon dioxide levels have to be is pre-industrial. And so it should really be called the 250 movement, but they didn't ask me. Anyway, so that's my quick overview.
Hello.
Hey.
I have two questions. The first one's really quick. It's like, where do you align yourself along a political spectrum? In that, do you consider yourself a left libertarian, socialist, humanist, what have you, if you want to give yourself a label, which you probably don't? That's the first one. The second one is you're very anti-civilization in general. Are there any civilizations you believe have come anywhere near close to what you would consider sustainable or human? Personally, I think post-Civil War Spanish anarchist society probably represents that to me. Is there a society that ever represented that to you or was close? And what is it? Thank you.
Okay, great, thanks. So far as the first one, it took me a long time to even really identify myself as a writer, because all the label thing really scares me, because I don't know what the hell it means. I have, over the past several months, been kicked out of the Anarchy Club. I'm probably going to have to return my secret decoder ring that I got in my box of Anarchy Jacks. And, you know, so I don't know. I mean, where do I put myself? I put myself... okay, I'm comfortable saying that I'm an animist. I believe that everything is alive and sentient and numinous, I think, if I'm using that word correctly. But that's not really political. I don't know. It's pretty funny, because I fall. I mean, if I have to like pick issue by issue, you know, as long as we're going to have civilization, I think the United States should have some sort of, you know, socialized healthcare. So that makes me a fucking liberal. But then on the other hand, I think that, I mean, I'm against the death penalty because it's racist and classist. But actually, my biggest problem with the death penalty is I think it should be a lot more broadly applied. You know, it's like one of the jokes I used to tell is that it's not very funny. It's two riddles. The first one is, what do you get when you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And the second one is, what do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, 8,000 dead human beings? And that's retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide. So, Bhopal. And so, honestly, I don't have a problem with, like, the death penalty as such. I mean, I got a fucking list, I got to tell you. You know, Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, should hang for what he did at Bhopal. I got no problem with that. So does that make me a conservative? I don't know. I think it's really fucking stupid to destroy land bases. What's that make me? Smart, I guess. Not a capitalist. You know, so I don't know. I don't know where I fit with any of this stuff. So that's the first question. Second question. If we define civilization carefully, which I try to do, which is any way of life characterized by the growth of cities, and a city is people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources, then no civilization has ever really come close. You know, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about industrial civilization, Western civilization, or the Chinese, or the Mayans, or the Kohoka Mound Builders. They all destroyed their land base. And civilizations are based on slavery, forced labor, and forced labor of non-humans. And Lewis Mumford's Myth of the Machine is a really good book to read about that. But if we're talking about societies in general, there have been a lot of societies that have been sustainable. The Talawa, on whose land I now live, the Talawa Indians, they lived here for at least 12,500 years, if you believe in science. And if you believe in the myths of the Talawa, then they've lived here since the beginning of time. They were not, I don't know much about the Talawa gender relations. I know that some of the indigenous peoples around here did not have egalitarian gender relations. And I know that there have been and are indigenous peoples who have very low rates of rape and other sexual abuse, and other indigenous peoples who have higher rates. So, there are some predictable markers. You know, patriarchy is an obvious marker. High militarization is an obvious marker for high rape. But there have been those that have been low rape. And I'm told that the Okanagan had no word in their language that meant violation of a woman. I mean, they did have a word that meant violation of a woman, but the word literally meant somebody looked at me in a way I don't like. They didn't have a word for child abuse. And that is indicative of quite possibly egalitarian. It's possibly indicative of a non-rape or low-rape culture. And I don't know enough about the Spanish anarchists to really give much of an opinion on them. I know that they were under a lot of stress, you know, obviously in the 30s fighting the fascists, and stress makes it more difficult to have an egalitarian culture for a lot of reasons. And I also know that this Spanish anarchists had some great models for what. See, that's the thing too. You know, once again, it's incredibly important as we take down the system to be building up alternative institutions. And once again, I like to make fun of the permaculturalists, but I think that there's really important work being done by permaculturalists to help build up these alternative institutions. And the Spanish anarchists had some really good models for that with some of their schooling. But that's really the extent of my knowledge about the Spanish anarchists. Have there been any civilizations that have been sustainable, which is the prime thing for me, and egalitarian? No. Have there been cultures sustainable and egalitarian? Yes. And if there's a guy who comes up next, could we have a couple of women after that?
Okay. All right.
When I come up? Or there could be a woman next. That'd be fine.
All right, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, so I'm taking this American Indian resistance class taught by a Nakota Indian. And when he found out that I believed that military resistance or armed resistance was possible, he wanted to have a meeting with me. And we met Friday morning. And one of the things he said, having to do with if civilization collapses, was his question was, well, aren't they just going to rebuild it? And I've heard that before, and the only thing that I can think to say is, well, I don't really have a response to that. My only response is that it's still urgent that we get rid of it now because of all the destruction that it's wreaking. And what do you say to that? Like, yeah.
I usually say three teams. If it's appropriate, I say goodbye. But before then, or sometimes, whatever, the two main answers I have is one is that civilization will never rise again because the easily accessible reserves of oil are gone. There will never be another oil age. There will never be another iron age. There will never be another bronze age. This is a one-time blowout. So get it while you can cheap. There will never be any more. I mean, the topsoil is gone. You cannot have an extractive culture when there's nothing left to extract. And that doesn't mean that we are not facing an extremely bleak future. I think that Mad Max is probably pretty much what we're going to see. And we can talk about that in a second. But the good thing is that oil, the gasoline decays pretty quickly, so Mad Max won't last very long. But so this will never rise again like this. There will be feudal takeovers, and there will be probably a return to even more slavery than there is currently. But this industrial system cannot happen again. It's not physically possible. So first thing. The second thing is when somebody says, well, gosh, it will just rise up again. My response is usually, okay, so pretend you're lying in bed and you hear your family members, or you hear some people you love screaming in agony, and then you wake up and you look up above you and you see this axe murderer standing there with an axe raised. And so is what you do is turn to your sweetheart and say, darling, honey bunch, what are we going to do to make sure that no axe murderers break into our home tomorrow? What are we going to do to guarantee that this doesn't happen again? And frankly, I wish we had the luxury to worry about whether it rises up again. Let them worry about it, those who come after. Because right now we got our fucking hands full dealing with the planet being murdered right now. You know, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. How bad does it have to get before you'll say, it's okay? I was doing a talk in Portland several years ago, and this guy came up to me afterwards and said, you know, now is not the time to fight back. And I said, okay, great. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. You stop me when it's time. 91%, 92%, 93%, 94%, 95% of all the fish, large fish in the oceans are gone. 96%, 97%, 98%, 99%, 100% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Is that time yet? And he said, it will never be time. And I said, thank you very much. We don't have anything to say to each other. And so the point is, my responses are, one, this civilization will never rise again. Two, we are in a crisis. The planet is in a crisis. Right now, the world is being dismembered. And three, you give me a threshold at which you might think it's time to fight back. You set the threshold, and then we'll stick to it. I'll come back to you when we reach it. Is the threshold that there is right now, there is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in much of the oceans. Many places, like 50 times as much plastic as phytoplankton. 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton will be the equivalent of every time you take a bite, there's a 90% chance that it's styrofoam. And so you tell me, where is it okay? Is it 80%, 90%, 100%? I mean, I'm sorry, 80 times, 90 times, 100 times? And how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? You know, it's like cancer is a disease caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Gosh, when you get carcinogens in every mother's breast milk, maybe you're going to get some cancer. How close does it have to get before you'll fight back? I mean, if people came into our homes and they started cramming arsenic down our throats, we would fucking do something. But when it happens because it's, you know, chemical company CEOs, well, we can't fight back because if we do, then, well, gosh, they'll just, you know, raise up again. You know, it's like, I can't stop these burglars because there'll be some more. It's fuck that. You know, that's another thing people say is that, you know, if you take out a dam or if you just stop one CEO, then, you know, another one will just replace them. Well, according to that logic, well, why don't we just not put any rapists in prison? You know, there's just going to be another one. And why don't we just not stop any murderers? There's just going to be another one. Oh, somebody wants to say hi. Anyway, so that's the answer. That's my answer. I don't know what your answer is. That's the only answer there is.
Hi, if global consumerism is what's raping our lands, what do you suggest we do, like, in our own little part? I mean, we go to protests, we try to speak up and sign petitions and get, you know, news and media to, you know, give us a voice, try to reach out and get people, you know, active in this. What else? What, like, can you give us some suggestions on what you think needs to happen next? Maybe even just on an individual level at home. I mean, you made a comment about the permaculturists, and at least, you know, at least they're trying to self-sustain the environment they are living in, right, and producing food for themselves. So, thanks.
I can't really answer in specific what people should. Well, okay, in general, my answer is that what we need to do is that we need to put our bodies in between the oil economy and life on the planet. If space aliens came down and they were systematically destroying the planet, we would fight back. We would, if we fully internalize the understanding that we live under government occupation, we would fight back. And we would use whatever means are necessary. What would Russian partisans in World War II, what would they do if the Germans built an arms warehouse and they had access to it? They'd burn it down. And then the Germans would build it again. And then the Russian partisans would burn it down again. And the Germans would build it again. The Russians would burn it down again. And so on one level, what we need to do, if salmon could take on human manifestation, what would they do? I think we know the answer to that. If hammerhead sharks could take on human manifestation, what would they do? If migratory songbirds, there's between 5 and 30 million migratory songbirds every year are killed by cell phone towers. If migratory songbirds could take on human manifestation, what would they do to cell phone towers? And, okay, but I'm not going to recommend that people take out the industrial infrastructure, primarily because I don't think anybody would listen to me anyway. But having said that, the first and most important thing I think we need to do, as all of my American Indian friends say to me, is we need to decolonize our hearts and minds. And we need to move our allegiance from the industrial system to the land where we live. And we need to, it's like, what do all the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, as that which must be preserved. And the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that is insane, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. So the first thing we need to do is to transfer our allegiance to the natural world where we live, to the land base where we live, and to the natural world in general. And when people say, how can we save the salmon? They're not really asking, how can we save the salmon? What they're asking is, how can we save salmon without removing dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping industrial agriculture, without stopping fish farms, without stopping the murder of the oceans, without stopping global warming? Ask any reasonably intelligent 7-year-old how to stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, and she will tell you stop burning oil and gas. Ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for a green high-tech consulting firm how to stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, and they'll give you an answer that probably has a lot more to do with saving the high-tech consulting firm than it does saving the natural world. And so what we need to do first and foremost is to transfer our allegiance to the land and make that allegiance absolute. It's like, I want to go back to something and then come back to your question, which is, I mentioned the Mad Max thing. And as this culture continues to collapse, oh, that was funny too, that the man that you said, you know, he said, if civilization comes down, it's like, if, I'm sorry, where's the magical thinking there? I mean, peak oil, peak soil, peak water, it's peak everything, like Richard Heinberg says. I mean, this can't last and it won't last. But as this culture collapses, it's going to be hell. It's already hell for people in non-industrialized nations. And it's already hell for non-humans. It's already hell for hammerhead sharks. It's already hell for many, many women. But the point is that as this current society collapses, things are going to get much worse in many ways. And if you want to know what happens when a patriarchal society collapses, look at the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there are mass rapes and organized rapes. And yes, there are already mass rapes in the US and in Canada, and that will get worse. And so we need to prepare ourselves for that. And we need to prepare ourselves for local food supplies through the permaculture people. We also need to prepare ourselves for the chaos through this collapse. And I really love Andrea Dworkin's quote, or the line by Andrea Dworkin about, my prayer for women of the 21st century is harden your hearts and learn to kill. And women need to learn self-defense. And second, men, and this is just as important, if not more so, men must make our allegiance to women absolute. And men need to say, you know, you will harm this woman over my dead body. Not in a patriarchal protective sense, but in a community sense. And we need to say the same thing. As this culture collapses, the open racists are going to become even more open. This is what happens when a society collapses. And we need to say the same thing, that people of color, they have to get ready to defend themselves. And white people, we need to make our allegiance to people of color absolute. And it's the same with the natural world, that we need to say, my allegiance to the salmon is absolute. So that's something we need to do. And then so far as what you specifically should do, I can't say because I don't know you and I don't know your gifts, but I have a couple of sort of questions that I ask myself and that I ask other people. One of them is, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you in all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you in all the universe? So, for example, people have said, my God, Derek, you need to be an organizer. You need to stop writing and be an organizer. But Jesus fucking Christ, look at this. I don't know if you'll be able to see the floor at all. There's like several empty bags of potato chips, you know? It's like, don't ask me to organize anything. See, that's a great thing about the whole burglar thing, is that the reason that they weren't able to see the little cameras is because there's so much shit here that I put the cameras behind these things. And it's so great because I put them behind some CDs. And this, you can see this one guy, he was looking at the CDs right in front of the cameras. Like, thank you so much. Anyway, so I'm not an organizer. And I'm actually physically kind of a klutz. And one reason I should not mess with explosives, because my only D in college was in my quantitative analysis chemistry lab. And I'm absent-minded. So it's like, yeah, we're going to go blow something up. And then first off, don't have me touch the explosives, because D in chemistry, you know, it's like, don't do it. And second, you know, it's like, so we get out to the place, we're all ready, we're going to blow up the big nasty thing. And it's like, okay, Derek, timer. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's on the kitchen table. I'll be back in about 45 minutes. So it's like, I don't have gifts in that way. I do have gifts for writing. And so that's the first thing. What are your gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? I mean, I know people who are amazing teachers, and I know people who who are amazing with chemistry. And I know people who are amazing gardeners. You know, it's like, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base and your community? And the next question is, what do you get off on? And I love this because I was out. One reason I don't get burned out is because I love so much what I'm doing. And love is such a fancy word. That's why I love, what do you get off on? I was hanging out with this wetland specialist. We were stopping this developer, and the wetland specialist was digging around in the soil, and then he'd rub the soil between his fingers and check out what color it was and then match that to this chart. That would help him determine if they're wetland soils. And I looked at him and said, do you get off on this? And he said, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs. And I just started laughing and said, this is great, because if I had to do this every day, I would just kill myself. You know, this would be hell. I don't like this. But on the other hand, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. You know, I just totally get off on that sort of nerd bullshit. And so what are your gifts and what do you get off on? And then one more thing is that, you know, I talk about bringing it all down, which I think is desperately needed. And at the same time, like I said, only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. And one of the things that's really important about this is, and I forgot what I was going to say, is let's see. What do you get off on? Well, I don't remember. I remember what it is. But the big difference is not between those who militantly resist and those who nonviolently resist. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who don't do anything. So really, what I want people to do is something, and to start off with something. And it sounds like you already are, and that's great. And then do something more, and then do something more. And then if something doesn't work, try something else. And remember that the point is not to be an activist and to feel good. And the point is not to be a writer and feel good. And the point is not to do this Q&A and to feel good. And the point is not to, you know, do Frank's amazing films. By the way, you should all donate heavily to Frank, because he's amazing and his film's amazing. And he needs money, so donate heavily. Anyway, not only what was I saying? So the point is not to make amazing films like Frank does. The point is to win. And the point is to, and my definition of winning is making it so that there are more wild salmon every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and less dioxins in every mother's breast milk every year than the year before, and so on and so on. So figure out what winning means to you and figure out how you're going to get there, and then do it.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go through a bit of an anecdote to get to my question. I'm having a really interesting day because I just got back from the big 350 day of non-action. And after that, there was something sort of like this, sort of like a little conference in a church not far from here, with a bunch of climate change experts giving speeches. And one of them was this guy, Bill Rees, a local academic who kind of pioneered the concept of the ecological footprint. And his latest thing is give up growth. He's talking about we need to like give up economic growth. And that strikes me as a potentially useful kind of philosophy to be talking to people about. Do you think that it is or might be?
Okay, wait, don't go away. Because I heard everything you said. Except that the microphone crapped out during the actual question.
So I guess my question was that there's people out there, like this concept of giving up economic growth as sort of like the
oh,
sort
I
of,
heard that.
The sort of our next, you know, sort of like one of the next paradigm sort of shifts our society needs to look at after, say, coming to terms with the reality of global warming or just the crisis facing the planet. Do you think that that sort of notion of like this whole like, you know, non-growthist kind of thing that seems to be gaining some currency is like worthwhile, or is it kind of like for whatever reason sort of like a waste of time or whatever to your way of looking at what we should be doing? Yeah.
Great, thank you. And I want to say thank you for all the questions so far. They've been just absolutely just great questions. And this one, I think, sure. I mean, anyone but a madman or an economist, insofar as there's a difference, understands you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I mean, who's a fucking moron who came up with that idea in the first place? It's just absolutely absurd and horrendous and ridiculous and self-evidently ecocidal and suicidal. It's just fucking nonsense. But the fact that it's fucking nonsense, and yet it is still one of the things that I think is pretty important, at least for me to understand, is that economics is not really a descriptor. Capitalism and, you know, the theories of Milton Friedman and the theories of Adam Smith or any of them are not really so much descriptive as they are rationalizations for the urge to steal and destroy. And I mean, I love this line by Eduardo Galeano, that the theories of Milton Friedman gave him the Nobel Prize, and they gave Chile Augusto Pinochet. And the point is that we can all agree that infinite growth on a finite planet is really absurd. But as long as we don't live in a democracy, as long as we're not actively making decisions, it doesn't fucking matter. Yes, it does matter, because it's important for us to expose those lies. But at some point, we need to confront and to take down those systems of oppressive power, because they're not going to change. They're not going to give up on their growth because they're making money off of it and because they're gaining power off of it. And we can all talk. It's like I saw this program the other day, PBS, yesterday, 2 days ago, whenever it was. I don't know when it was. Yesterday. And there was it was about global warming in Bangladesh. And I believe it's – no, I'm sorry. I don't know where the hell I heard this. Somewhere. That there was that there will be 35 million environmental refugees from Bangladesh because of rising sea levels. And there was this guy from an NGO who said, well, we think that China and the United States need to take a lot of those refugees because they're putting out the most carbon. And when the NGO said this, I said, well, great. I mean, I didn't say it. I went on the program. I said to myself, you know, great. I think that pink fairies should fly out of my nose and circle the moon. You know, big fucking deal. You know, we can all wish for, you know, we can all wish we had pink ponies, and it doesn't fucking matter. You're still not going to get one for Christmas. And so my point is that we can wish for, and we need to break that paradigm, but we can wish all we want for a non-growth economy. And as long as a growth economy continues to serve those in power, they're going to continue to enforce it. So, yes, it's absolutely desperately important to demythologize a growth economy. At the same time, that is not sufficient. That is necessary but not sufficient. At some point, we need to stop them. I mean, I was thinking about this, that, you know, those in power, they're like the CEOs, they make their decisions, they say, based on the bottom line, their bottom line, which is, do we make a profit or do we lose money? Well, okay, one of the ways that we have not explored nearly enough is like, okay, motherfucker, put this on your bottom fucking line. You know, we need to make it so expensive that they cannot do tar sand extraction. We need to make it so fucking expensive that they cannot do mountaintop removal. We need to make it so expensive that they cannot maintain the oil economy. And there are a bazillion different ways you can do this, from the absolutely most nonviolent to the absolutely most violent. I mean, I want to be very, very clear that, you know, especially for the feds listening in on this, that that one can do this through nonviolent means. We need to, fine, you're going to make economic decisions. We need to add something to the equation because you are not counting the real world in your bottom line. And so we need to bring some consequences into this, and we need to make it so a growth economy. See, here's the problem is that those who are actually the primary movers of and the decision makers for destroying the planet are insulated from the effects of their decisions. And so it's not a coincidence that Warren Anderson had his headquarters in, I believe it was Delaware, and the factory manufacturing the poison was in Bhopal. It's not a coincidence that it's not a coincidence that Barack Obama does not live in a flooded village in Bangladesh with no water. And we need to make it so that those who are making those decisions feel the consequences of their decisions. And those consequences of their decisions they don't continue to be externalized onto the salmon and onto native peoples and onto the poor. You know, it's really fucking basic that when I was a little kid, if I made a mess, I had to clean it up. And I was not allowed to externalize the consequences of my decisions onto others and say, oh, this is just capitalism. And we shouldn't let them get by with that either. With all the world at stake, we need to not let them get by with that. And they won't stop. Lundy Bancroft wrote this great book called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men. A great book. One, probably the best or second best book I ever read about abuse. The other one being Trauma and Recovery by Judith Herman. And one of the things he talks about in there is he says that abusers can be addicted to their entitlement. And the question always to ask is, okay, they don't beat people up because they lose control. Because if they did, if people simply lost their temper, if men simply lost, if abusers simply lost their temper, why don't they beat up policemen? Why don't they beat up their boss? Huh, what do you know? They actually have control over their temper because they know whom they can beat. And when they destroy things, do they destroy their own stuff? Huh, what do you know? And so he says, the question we always need to ask is who benefits from that behavior? And the other thing he says is that one of the problems is that abusers are addicted to their sense of entitlement. Stop me when this sounds familiar with capitalists. They're addicted to their sense of entitlement. And the cliche with the addicts is that they don't change until they hit bottom. You know, we've all heard that cliche of heroin addicts are not going to quit until they hit bottom, alcoholics, whatever. The problem is that abusers don't hit bottom. Everybody else around them hits bottom. They're doing very well, thank you very much. In fact, they have ice cream. They have access to ice cream 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, that's us capitalists. And so they will not give up this entitlement voluntarily. And like Lundy Bancroft says, an abuser only changes when he has no choice. And what we need to do is to give them no choice. How you do that is up to you.
Hey, Derek, I'm wondering, one, what your relationship is with news and sort of like how you follow news or if you even keep up with it. And two, if you have a favorite journalist.
God, that's great. Thank you. I've never been asked those questions before. How I keep up on news? I check the Al Jazeera website. I check a website called antiwar.com. I'm on a global warming listserv. There are some people who, I mean, lots of people forward me lots of stuff. I will, okay, this is kind of embarrassing, but sometimes I will watch Keith Olbermann with my mom. And he pisses me off because he's such a fucking liberal. And at the same time, I like the fact that he's at least attacking, you know, the right wingers. I wish he would attack the left wingers the same way he does the right wingers, but we can't have everything, I guess. Favorite journalists. my favorite journalists are not, I mean, even though I watched Keith Olbermann with my mom, I'm not going to put him as one of my favorite journalists at all. Dar Jamail comes to mind. I think he's great. Chris Hedges, I like him. Frank Lopez, to whom you should donate money. Let's see. I really, so far as mainstream journalists, I think a lot about the fate of Julius Streicher, Streicher. He was one of the nine main criminals tried at the main Nuremberg trials. He was one of the nine top Nazi war criminals. And he was not tried for killing anyone. He was not tried. It was like Goering was another one of the big ones. Kaltenbrunner, who was, you know, head of the Secret Service and intelligence work. Horrible, horrible. Gestapo. Jodl, who was one of the generals who ran the war. They all were, you know, what we'd expect. And one of the ones that was kind of unexpected was Streicher. And the reason Streicher was there, what Streicher did is ran a newspaper. And what the prosecutor said is that without his constant propaganda, there would have been no one to commit the atrocities that the Nazis perpetrated. That he, by putting out the propaganda he did, called for and led to the Capital H Holocaust. And my point is that there is a precedent in international law for what should happen to journalists who help to foment illegal and offensive wars. And I think that if there were a realistic international war crimes tribunal, well, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, et cetera, would be in the docket, but so would people from the New York Times. So would all the other people who lied their way into this war. And I used to get, I got some anger in my voice here. I need to get some therapy, I think. Anyway, I got some anger in my voice here. And it's interesting because I'm not actually that angry at journalists anymore. I used to be really, really angry at them all the time until I realized that their function is to tell lies. And we don't expect when we get a press release from Monsanto that it's going to be true. We expect that any communique coming from Monsanto Incorporated is going to serve the ends of Monsanto Incorporated. So why would we believe anything else from the New York Times Corporation? It's a corporation, and it has as its function amassing wealth and also maintaining the status quo. And so, and there's another part to this, which is, as a writer, I consider words to be sacred. And the question I try to ask myself with every sentence is this sentence true? And that's most important to me. No, what's most important to me is stopping this culture from killing the planet. But that's second most important to me is that I attempt to tell the truth. And so I hold an especial hatred for writers and journalists who do not tell the truth as they understand it to be. Those of us whose work is words, or in Frank's case, images and words, we have a sacred responsibility to attempt, no, not to attempt, because fuck attempting. We have a sacred responsibility to tell the truth as we understand it to be. And we have a sacred responsibility to fight power. Somebody once asked me why it is, and those of you who have read Walking on Water know that when I teach, I only use praise with my students. And somebody at a talk once asked me why it is that I would only praise students, but at the same time, I have no problem calling CEOs nasty-ass motherfuckers and, you know, attacking them every way I can. And what I said is that if I have power over someone, it is my responsibility to use that power only to help them become the people that they are. If I have power over others, it is my responsibility to use that power only to help them become the person they are. It's like the first rule of editing if I edit for somebody, my job is to help them say what they want to say in the way they want to say it, only better. My job is not to help them to say what I want them to say, or to help them say what they want to say in my way. My role is to help them say what they want to say in the way they want to say it. So if I have power over someone, I must use it only to help them. If, on the other hand, I see someone who is using their power over someone else who's misusing that power, it is my responsibility to stop them using any means necessary. And so journalists have extraordinary power, and I have an extraordinary hatred for those journalists who, for whatever reason, do not use that power to serve life and to serve living communities and to serve those who are being crushed under the iron boot of capitalism. That's all. Oh, I want to say one more thing, which is that Dar Jamail, one of the things I really like about him is that he was just this regular old guy up in Alaska, and he saw a problem, which is that he didn't like how the corporate press was covering the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so what he did is he decided, you know what, if they're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. And he went over to Iraq and he told the stories that the other people weren't telling. And I fucking love that. You know, it's like, if you see a problem, well, you know what? Nobody else is going to fix it. So just go do it yourself, you know? I love the fact that, and we can all do that with whatever our various gifts are, you know? You see a problem? Well, step in and fix it. Don't wait for somebody else to do it. Don't hope it gets done.
Derek, I wonder if there's any kind of culturals or movement examples that have been able to kind of push back against civilization collapse, like that you can think of, inspire you or otherwise?
Well, one of the groups that, of course I'm inspired by especially indigenous resistance all over the world and all through history, even though sadly Tecumseh didn't win. But currently one of the groups that I have, I derive a lot of inspiration. I've been doing the Endgame talk for years, and I was going to transition away from it to a slideshow that was a slideshow of basically terrorists through history, which included, you know, Jesus and John Brown, Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman. I can't remember her name right now, but Geronimo's sister, I believe. Maud Gunn, who was with the Gaelic revival, and also the Pankhurst, you know, suffragettes. And anyways, I did, unfortunately, I did this slideshow a couple times, and the audience response was, I mean, I'm sitting up there talking about the slideshow, basically crying my eyes out at all the bravery of all these people. And the people in the audience are like, so I did it twice, I'm done again. But there's a whole, you know, there's a whole long list of movements historically. I mean, like the Pullman Porter strike, you know, that's not against civilization, but it's amazing, you know. It's great when you see that a lot of the leaders of the civil rights movement were the great-grandchildren, I'm sorry, were the grandchildren of the Pullman Porters, and they were the grandchildren of slaves. And you see this continuity, you know, of just building up these movements over time, and that moves me so deeply. Okay, having said all that, once again, they're not anti-civilization, but, you know, I mean, the Haymarket Martyrs, I have great respect for them. Okay, but anti-civ, I like the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND. They have reduced output, oil output, by about 20%. And some people have argued, well, you know, they just want a bigger slice of the pie. And that's partially true. But the fact is that they are indigenous peoples who are fighting for their land. And that's great. And I want to say asterisk, which I'm going to come back to. And one of the great lines of the Movement for the Emancipation of Niger Delta is they have said, it must be clear to you oil workers. They said this to oil companies and the workers. It must be clear that the government cannot protect you. Leave our land or die in it. And we need to have that sort of courage because our backs are against the fucking wall, you know? What are we getting in 5 years? We're going to have the 375 movement and then the 395 movement, and then the 415 movement, and then the 450 movement, and then the Please Not Venus movement. You know, it's like, what, you know, what's the number? Where's the threshold? You know, give me a threshold at which we'll finally say, look, our backs are against the fucking wall and leave our planet or die in it. You know, capitalists, leave our planet or die in it. And, okay, back to the asterisk. You know, I said that I've been inspired by indigenous movements, but I think it's absolutely crucial. I did a talk a few weeks ago in Portland, and this one woman at the end asked me, you know, so I want the dams to come out, but, you know, who's going to do it? Because I'm scared. And I said, you know, we're all scared. I mean, that's what happens when you're in war. We're terrified. I'm fucking terrified every moment. And then one of the things I said is, I don't know who is going to take out the dams, but this is what I know is crucial, is we as white people need to not force the indigenous people to yet again be on the front lines. We need to not use indigenous people as cannon fodder. I mean, they've been fighting these battles forever. And you know what? The white people are primary beneficiaries, and we're the ones who need to fight the battles. You know, we need to not let the poor do it. We who have privilege need to join in. It's not up to those who already have nothing left to lose. You know, so when I talk about MEND being having reduced the oil output by 20%, and for that I admire them. And I don't know other things about them. I don't know their gender relations. I don't know anything about that. So they may be terrible, they may be great. I have no idea. But my point in bringing them up is not to say that we need to wait for other people to do it. Oh, I got to tell you this story. I love this story. Probably, let's see, 1997, 12 years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, down in Peru. And that was the group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house, and they had the siege there for 70 days or 40 days or whatever. I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, not one in the siege, obviously, somebody who was exiled. And I called, two things. One is, I asked him, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, what we want is for the people to be able to grow and distribute their own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do that. And that's the whole struggle right there. That's the entire struggle, is that self-sufficiency, communal self-sufficiency. Anyway, set that aside, is I sent an email to The Nation magazine saying, I'm interviewing a member of the Tupac Amaristas, and would you like to run it? And I got a call from the editor, and she said, this sounds really interesting. So what's going to be your focus? And I said, well, we're going to talk about what they want for the people of Peru. We're going to talk about their struggle there. And she's like, yeah, that sounds great. And I said, also, we're going to talk about how important it is that we bring this struggle against capitalism home to the United States, and that we fight this battle here and not just in the non-industrialized nations. Hello? Hello? Are you there? And she said, well, we're going to have to think about this interview, and I'll get back to you with our editorial board decision. And so my point is that it's really safe and easy to talk about how important it is for those brave people in the non-industrialized nations to rise up against the oppressors. But suddenly when we talk about doing it here, it's like, whoo, time to take a deep breath. And so when I say I admire them, and when I talk about admiring the members of the Irish resistance, that A, doesn't mean that they're all perfect, and B, doesn't mean that we need to put it in the safety of history or the safety of non-industrialized nations. I want to say one more thing, which is Nat Turner's rebellion, the slave rebellion, which, by the way, there was like 300 slave rebellions between 1800 and 1860, a whole, but maybe it wasn't 300, but there was a bunch of them, 150, a lot of them. And, okay, there was three. Just kidding. There was a lot of them. And one of the things about Nat Turner's rebellion that's really extraordinary and wonderful is that they didn't rape anyone, no one. And that, I think, is really crucial too, that it's absolutely crucial that as we fight back, that we don't, I mean, it's like one of the things that really pisses me off is even during the Capital H Holocaust, there were brothels in the sex slaves in the camps. And for a long time, I thought that those were just used by the guards, but it ends up they were also used to give special benefits to prisoners. And it's like, fuck, you know, if you're in a fucking death camp, and now what, you're still going to essentially rape a sex slave. It's like, that's not okay. So when we fight back, you know, I got no problem with killing. Like I said, I got myself a fucking list, but we need to make sure that I think it's important that we don't and in any war there will be, to use the United States phrase, collateral damage. I'm not talking about that, but here's what I'm trying to say, is that when we build our resistance movement, we should also focus on not perpetuating the patriarchy's atrocities, which doesn't mean we don't fight back, because you can certainly fight a war without rape. But that's the thing, is we need to fight a war. There's already a war going on. We need to fight back.
Hi, Jensen. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you.
Answer what you will. I've got three. They're kind of important. Quick, do what you can. So we're speaking to you from Vancouver, site of the 2010 Olympic Paralympic Games. There's been all kinds of changes happening in our city to do with these Olympics, the sort of intensification of corporate capitalist greed and control. I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of how important a focus it is, because a lot of the activists are spending all of their time organizing around this event. And whether...
Okay, can we do these one question at a time?
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll forget.
So, Olympics, is it a good focus for activists to break the spell of the glorification of the system?
Another great question. And I don't feel comfortable answering that question because I'm not there. And if you are called to work against that and then to use that also as a larger podium, then that's great. And if at the same time That's not what's important to you, but you are instead worried about the collapse of grizzly bear populations because of the collapse of salmon populations, then work on that. You know, I think that that, you know, okay. So I live in Northern California, and people there may or may not have heard of the Emerald Triangle. This area is known just a little bit for growing marijuana, and just a little bit. And in California, you can get what are called Prop 215 cards, which are medical marijuana cards. And this is going to have a point, don't worry. And the county where I live, they had a rule that you could have for your own personal medical use up to 99 plants. And now there are those who thought that 99 plants was excessive. And they wanted to reduce the number of plants that you're allowed. And so the board of supervisors, which is county commissioners, I don't know what you have up in BC, if it's county commissioners or board of supervisors or what. But anyway, the board of supervisors here, which is the ruling body for the county, was going to change the rules and to reduce it to 6 plants is all you can have. Where's the, there we go, 6. And it was pretty fucking amazing because the board of supervisors room was packed. And this was participatory democracy in action, because if the board of supervisors would have reduced it to 6, they would have been killed. This was the entire community turning out to not allow the board of supervisors to reduce it to serve the cops and the churches. And so for one glorious evening, Del Norte County had a democracy. This is what democracy is supposed to look like, which is the rabble comes in and says, fuck you, you're not going to take this away from us. Okay, that's the good news. The bad news is when we have any meeting having anything to do with salmon or stopping off-road vehicles, there's 5 people show up, and it's the same fucking 5 people every goddamn time. I wish people loved the salmon as much as they love marijuana. And so my point is that, what the hell am I don't know what my point is, but my point is that if people can get riled up about the Olympics, I think that's great. And that's a way to open doors. You know, when I talk to small business owners, I don't talk about salmon because they don't give a shit. I talk about Walmart because Walmart's destroying their livelihood. And so you find a place, you find those wedges. When I talk to college students, a lot of times they don't give a shit about salmon either. So one of the things I talk about sometimes with them is entering the wage economy and how stupid it is that you have to get a job in order to survive. I mean, whose fucking idea was that to come up with? That's a terrible idea. And that really speaks to a lot of college students. And so my point is find a wedge issue and dive in. And if the Olympics are an issue, great. And at the same time, don't forget the other stuff, because the salmon don't have time. Are there sturgeon up there? There's sturgeon down here.
Yeah.
I think that's
and it. They don't have time either.
Okay, I'm going to try and combine this one. It has to do with technology. As the oil companies decline, there's a new energy sector, solar power, wind power, that's coming up. And it's going to be big business, and there's going to be a lot of money in it. Although there's some people saying that because there's the chance for lots of new startups, it could be an energy revolution, and it could be local energy produced locally. I'm wondering whether you think solar panel technology is on our side or not. You're doing something there. And then
the universal masturbation symbol. Well, no, universal male masturbation symbol. I should also be going like this or something. I don't know.
And the other bit of that is the role of advanced technology in post-civilization society. We've already got the towers up for the internet, which is potentially maybe not. What's your thoughts on the internet in post-civilization? Is it all gone primitivist, or is there any role it can have? Okay.
No, because the person to read on all this is Richard Heinberg. that he, and the party's over, and in Peak Everything, he talks about how there is nothing that can replace oil. And I mean, already there are various rare earths, I think, that are already becoming rare. There are already bottlenecks in producing solar panels. And a couple things. One is we have to remember that the military and corporations use the internet far more effectively than we could ever hope to. And much as I may love, you know, playing poker on the internet or, you know, internet, you know, betting on, you know, the fucking Yankees to lose, that doesn't alter the fact that those technologies allow members of the U.S. military to sit in Las Vegas or Florida and to kill people in Pakistan with Predator drones. And they allow accounting systems, and they allow the transfer of money, and they allow the movement of resources on scales that were unimaginable without computers. And computers are a net huge loss for the natural world. And as is, I mean, but here's the bottom line, is that any technologies that are not based on what the land gives willingly are not sustainable. Any technologies that are based on harming the land base are not sustainable. The only way you can live in place is to not hurt the land. That's how the Tala lived here for 12,500 years, is by not harming the land for that long. And that's how you survive, is actually by helping the land to become better in its own terms. That's how the land became so wonderfully wild and fecund in the first place, was that salmon make forests a better place by their simple existence. And redwood trees make salmon better because of their existence. And if the Tala were living here for 12,500 years, they were making the place better by their very existence, or they wouldn't have survived. And computers are extraordinarily toxic. And here's the thing, is that you can't take these technologies just independently. And you have to have solar power, you have to have mining in order to have copper wiring. You can't have all these groovy wind power things, which are, of course, they kill bats on a massive scale, but you can't have windmills without mining also. And so you can't have just, you know, as much as I love watching BBC Mysteries with my mom, or as much as I love a space heater for my toes, and as much as I love ice cream, you know, you can't have those without all the other technologies. And there's one more concept I want to introduce, which is very, very important, which is Lewis Mumford talked about something called a technics, T-E-C-H-N-I-C-S. And what that is that's the combination. Technologies don't exist in a vacuum, that you have a whole technics, which is the social structure that leads to and emerges from a technology. And he talked about democratic and non-democratic technics. And there are democratic technics would be technologies that are personal scale and are capable of being controlled at the personal scale. Pottery, for example. Anybody can make pottery. Arrowheads, fishing nets, you know, anybody could weave reeds into a basket. Basket weaving is a democratic technic, because you don't have to rely on Monsanto, or you don't have to rely on ADM or Cargill. And a non-democratic technic would be one that you cannot control in your community. Automobiles are non-democratic because I can't make one in my community. My neighborhood cannot make a car. You have to have an entire infrastructure, which means you have to have a whole non-democratic system, and you have to have this whole system of exploitation. So the question isn't whether we can save, because computers are inherently non-democratic, because me and my community cannot make them. Stone knives are democratic techniques, because I and my community could make them. So the only, and we can say the same thing really for sustainability, that the only sustainable techniques are democratic techniques, small scale, community. And you can't have wind electricity generation on a communal scale, because you still need the mining in order to create, to get the metals. And for in the short term, sure, there can still be, you know, through the crash, you know, I wish I had solar panels on my house so I could keep my refrigerator running, you know, after the crash finishes. But that's not sustainable in the long run. You know, it's going to go down, and then it's going to eventually stay down. And I guess to end, I want to go back to the question that was asked of me in Portland when the woman said, you know, who will stop this culture? You know, who will, you know, do what is necessary to protect the salmon? Or do what is, oh, I want to say two things. One is that I did a talk in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And when I was there, I was doing a benefit for an organization that was trying to stop a distant corporation from putting a toxic waste dump in their impoverished community made up of people of color, Hispanic people, Mexican Americans. And the cops were consistently arresting them, and they were not arresting the representatives of the distant corporations who were poisoning the people. And I said, what would happen if the cops actually enforced laws that we already have? What would happen if cops enforced cancer-free zones? What would happen if cops enforced dam-free zones, clear-cut-free zones, Olympic-free zones? What if cops enforced rape-free zones? And then, of course, you know, it's a joke, because that's not the real role of cops. That, you know, it's like a cop wrote to me one time, and he said, he was reading Endgame, and he really liked it. But he said, you know, one of the problems is that you seem to blame cops too much. And the cops, you know, cops are just, our job is to protect people from sociopaths. And I wrote back to him, I said, you know, I agree that part of the role of police is to protect us from sociopaths. My problem is they only protect us from the poor sociopaths, like the kids who burglarized my house. They don't protect us from the rich sociopaths. And I got another question for you, which is, why is it that when people go on strike, the cops, whenever they're called in to break the strike, they always go after the strikers? Why did they go after the capitalists and force them to terms? And he never wrote me back. But the point is, what would happen, since the police are not going to enforce cancer-free zones or rape-free zones, what would happen if we enforce cancer-free zones ourselves? And what would happen if we enforce rape-free zones? Have you heard of the Gulabi Gang? They're great. It's also called the Pink Sari Gang. And it's a group of women in India, large group, who have taken, they train in martial arts, and they go through villages, and if they see a man beating up a woman, they beat the shit out of him. And that happened in Maoist China, too, after the revolution. The woman would go through villages, and if they saw a man beating up a woman, they would beat him. If they saw him doing it again, they'd kill him. Wife beating went down. Pretty straightforward. So what would happen if we in our communities began to enforce rape-free zones? What would happen if we in our communities began to enforce Olympic-free zones, or cancer-free zones, dam-free zones, clear-cut-free zones? You know, choose your poison. And so now I want to go back to, and I want to end with that question that woman asked about, who is going to do this? Who is going to enforce a cancer-free zone? Who is going to enforce rape-free zones? Who is going to enforce fish farm-free zones? Who is going to enforce, you know, no stolen land zones, where the land goes back to the indigenous, the rightful owners? And so that's what I want to leave you with, is who's going to do it? Thanks.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Derek. We really appreciate your time. I know you much rather be writing or some shit. Hey, Derek, thanks a lot, okay. Man. Have a great night.
Thanks. Yeah, and give lots of money to Frank.
All right, thanks.
See you.
This presentation is brought to you by Submedia. You can check us out online at submedia.tv.